It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday, Republican frontrunner Donald Trump racking up primary wins in the big prize of Michigan, as well as Mississippi and Hawaii. Ted Cruz winning in Idaho. Now we have Trump expanding his lead in the White House nominating race. Coming after a week of blistering attacks from his party's establishment on the Democratic contest side, Bernie Sanders with a stunning but narrow victory over frontrunner Hillary Clinton in that Michigan primary upset. Clinton, though, winning convincingly in Mississippi, actually improving her delegate lead over Sanders. And joining us this hour to pick apart the Democratic and GOP races, Kedrin Bardwell, chair in the Department of Political Science at Simpson College in Indianola. Kedrin, welcome back to our program.
Good to be with you again.
Jim McCormick is with us as well, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Jim, always nice to have you on the program.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
If we could, let's start on the Democratic side and have our listeners join us as we talk about these races. And we want to know what's on your mind, your questions, your concerns, as you, along with us, chew over the latest slew of primary results, 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Last night, Bernie Sanders made all the pollsters eat several portions of humble pie. He won the Michigan primary over Hillary Clinton, 50% to 48%. And this happened when not a single poll, gentlemen, taken over the last month had Clinton leading by less than 5%. Percentage points. Many had that lead to 20 percentage points or even higher. Sanders' win in Michigan is seen as one of the greatest upsets in modern political history. Here he is speaking to reporters in Michigan last night. Bernie Sanders thanking supporters for a victory that defied the polls.
What tonight means is that the Bernie Sanders campaign, the people's revolution that we are talking about, the political revolution that we are talking about, is strong in every part of the country. And frankly, we believe that our strongest areas are yet to happen. We're going to do very, very well in the West Coast and other parts of this country.
Jim McCormick, what happened there in Michigan?
Well, I think it is the people know best, not the pollsters, I think would be one immediate takeaway that I have. I mean, the public really decided that they liked Bernie Sanders' message. And I think if you step back and look at it for a moment, just remember that really Michigan was really hit hard by the Great Recession of 2008. I can remember there were several years really up into 2012 when the unemployment rates in Michigan were in the 12%, and at one juncture it even reached 15% unemployment. So that state was really hit hard, and that's not so long ago, and much of it was due to companies moving out, this kind of outsourcing that has taken place, or that the auto industry had been at least seriously challenged in terms of its global leadership role and really surpassed. So I think it's really this kind of economic message that really helps us understand what really happened. And the pollsters really didn't tap into that. I'm really surprised that really across the board all the pollsters, because I was talking to someone right before the race, and I said, Mrs. Clinton is up 55 to 44. I don't think there's much of a chance that Sanders would challenge her. And of course, Nate Silver on his prediction market said that it was a 99% likelihood that Hillary Clinton would win Michigan. So, pollsters made a misstep here.
Mm-hmm. Nate Silver in a tweet today, comparing it to the past, looking back for a precedent to this miss by the pollsters in the famous New Hampshire upset in 2008. Nate Silver tweets, Clinton trailed Obama by 8 points. That was a big upset. But today, Sanders trailed Clinton by 21-1. Kedrin Bardwell, what do you have to add to that? Is it the economic anxiety that's at the heart of it? And why didn't the pollsters get to that with their polls?
Yeah, I think Jim's right on target. The first thing I would mention is that Sanders did make an emphasis when he was in Michigan to emphasize the trade, the idea that the trade deals that we've made have not been favorable to the workers in many of these manufacturing areas that you find in the upper Midwest, in Michigan, Ohio, over to Pennsylvania. So I think he capitalized on that message and the fact that Clinton, at least through her own positions and then through those of her husband, has been more of a free trade candidate, and that's a position that's not terribly popular in the upper Midwest. In terms of predicting that race, keep in mind that open primaries where independents and others can come over and vote in an opposite party primary are notoriously difficult to predict, and Michigan was an open primary, and I think that helped both Sanders and Trump in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. So could we have had scenarios where large numbers of, let's say, Democrats voted in the GOP primary, voting against Trump, say, oh, well, Hillary Clinton seems to have it in the bag, according to the polls, so let me weigh in on the other side of the equation. Do you think that's a possibility, Kedron?
Yeah, I have heard that over the years, but I haven't really seen any evidence of conspiratorial crossover voters, and I guess that's what I'd call that. More often, they're well-intentioned, principled voters who simply see that an issue that a candidate raises, even if they're someone who doesn't belong to their same party, is resonating, and I think that's part of what was going on with Trump doing well in Michigan. Is he and Sanders were both taking positions that the trade policies of the United mm-hmm. States have not been good for workers.
Mm-hmm. Jim, what do you think about that? Is the free trade Clinton's albatross?
Well, you know, she flip-flopped on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, she was partly – was really in the midst of the negotiation of it. And, of course, then last summer, early fall here, she said that, you know, she would not, as at least is presently written, would not agree to it. So I think, you know, what is her position on trade becomes an issue. And apparently – and I didn't see it, but there was an ad run in Michigan, too, about some previous interview that Secretary Clinton had back in 2012 that raised the question about what her position was really on outsourcing of jobs. So I think in that context, that probably very much helped Sanders. Just a comment on the independent voters. I'm not sure there was. I mean, I agreed with Kedron here that, you know, the likelihood of this kind of crossover, you know, kind of conscious crossover by some Democratic voters. I think it's really more some of the independents participating, because the turnout in Michigan was really quite high on both sides of the aisle. It was over 2 million if you count up, you know, all the votes, and roughly equal in both the Democratic and the Republican primaries. So I think there, you know, there was probably a lot of people staying at home, but the exit poll did show that both Trump and Sanders picked up about by the exit poll about 31% of the independents. So that was you know, an area where was very fertile ground for him.
Join our discussion with Jim McCormick, Kedron Bardwell, as we pick apart the latest results in this primary race for the White House in 2016. 1-866-780-9100. Jim joining us from Dubuque. Jim in Dubuque, welcome to the program. What is on your mind as you chew over these latest results?
Well, I am curious as to why we're not hearing anything in the media about third parties. I mean, yes, there are, quote, independent, unquote, voters, but why don't we hear about the Conservative Party or the Libertarian Party mm-hmm. or the Green Party or any of those others? Is there some kind of law that says we are not permitted, or is this collusion among the various parties, and would that be an antitrust?
Okay, I think we got the gist of it. Jim, your phone line is breaking up there. That's the people who don't want us to talk about third parties, I guess, attacking the phone lines. But, Jim, you got your message across. Kedron Bardwell, would you tackle that one? In past elections, we've certainly had the Greens, Ralph Nader, so forth, Ross Perot, and so forth.
Well, I would say that there are laws and there is collusion, actually. The whole system is rigged against third parties, and that's just a structural problem that can only be solved by changing some of the laws that relate to, first of all, our winner-take-all system. If you have a system that's winner-take-all at any district level, whether it's a House district or presidential level, you're going to disadvantage third parties and third-party voters, because they'll wonder as to whether or not their vote is wasted, because the chances of their candidate getting the most votes is very slim. There's also at the state level, there's actually a number of rules that the parties have both, as the caller said, colluded on, that make it very difficult for new candidates and third-party candidates to get on ballots. And there's a number of states, I'm thinking of places like Florida, where you have to pay huge, pretty huge filing fees if you want to run for a statewide office, and you have to gather pretty large numbers of signatures as well. So, yes, there is collusion by the two parties to make it more difficult for these candidates to get on the ballot.
Mm-hmm. And we do have that threat by Donald Trump, if he wasn't treated right by the Republican National Committee, to splinter off Jim McCormick. I guess that would be this election cycle's opportunity for a third party.
Well, yeah, and we also had Michael Bloomberg talking about, although he's now declined to run because he thinks it could help get a candidate into the presidency that he ultimately would not favor. So, you know, sometimes third parties also have to calculate what the consequences are. Certainly they can run on principle and get their message out, but is it going to affect the outcome, and is it going to produce an outcome that would be really dysfunctional for their longer-term goals?
What about the fact that we have in both columns, so we have outsiders at the top of the polls, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. So if you have outsiders, non-establishment candidates ranking up very high, does that preclude a third party coming in to find that groundswell of support, perhaps, Kedren?
I think so. I mean, some of the messages that are being brought in by these candidates, and remember, we've had a lot of candidates run this year. So if you have a pet issue or you have something that you really care about, chances are one of the candidates in this large field at one time was speaking to it. Where we see third parties able to make momentum is when they're able to take a message that the two parties are simply not addressing and bring it to the forefront. And what you're seeing this year is that both Trump and Sanders saw the Republican and Democratic parties as a proper vehicle for getting those concerns, whatever they happen to be, heard. And so, you know, where you might see a third party run is, again, with the Trump scenario where if he doesn't get the nomination ultimately, let's say we have a brokered convention, he might decide to run independently. But that traditionally only works when you have a huge reserve of your own money to spend. Someone like Ross Perot, for example, was able to do that, spend a lot of his own money on television advertising in order to get a substantial share in the general.
Join our discussion with Kedren Bardwell of Simpson College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Your questions, your thoughts, your concerns after this latest slew of primary results. 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's talk about Hillary Clinton's position right now as a front runner for the Democratic nomination. That narrow loss in Michigan, even though it was very surprising, she did wind up with an increase in her delegate lead. She scored a decisive victory in Mississippi. And earlier this week, while campaigning in Michigan, she sounded eager to wrap up this nomination process.
The sooner I could become your nominee, the more I could begin to turn our attention to the Republicans.
Okay, what about that premise, Jim McCormick? The sooner she can have be the presumed nominee, the sooner she can get at the Republicans. Does that really work? Does that favor someone that way?
Well, I think that she's already started to do that in terms of taking some shots at, you know, particularly at Mr. Trump here in terms of some of her discussion on the campaign trail. So I think she's already started to do that. But it would give her some advantage, it seems to me, to sort of lay out what her positions are and to try to, you know, move a little bit to the middle on some positions and maybe to enlarge her coalitions if she could wrap up the nomination. But I think that even with this Michigan loss, my own view is that, you know, she's really the prohibitive favorite still to gain the nomination. I think, you know, it does make for next week's primaries to be quite interesting because will in fact Bernie Sanders be able to take the same message that he took to Michigan to Ohio, which has some of the same demographics that a Michigan does in terms of being an industrial state in the Midwest and a, you know, large blue collar population here. And so she may have to wait a little bit before she can turn her attention more fully to the opposition candidate.
Kedren, I wonder if you could tell us what you think this narrow loss in Michigan may reveal about Hillary Clinton's weaknesses and how she might be best served by tweaking some of her messages.
Well, I think that's Jim's right, which is that she doesn't want to pivot too quickly to the general election message because she still needs to rally and get the base excited in her own party about her positions. And what the Sanders run is showing is that there is some dissatisfaction with the establishment Democratic positions on some of these issues. So I think she'll have to move a little bit towards some of those positions first, just to consolidate some of her support among the Democratic subgroups before she moves to pivot to the general election.
Okay. Let's turn to the GOP side. Last night, Donald Trump winning big in 3 out of the 4 states, speaking to supporters and reporters at one of his resorts in Jupiter, Florida last night. Donald Trump sounded very much like a general election candidate.
And I must tell you, it's very, very important as a Republican that our senators and that our congressmen get reelected, that we put a good group of people together, that we keep the people that are there. We have some terrific people. Not all of them are on my side, but we have some terrific people. And it's very, very important. If we're going to be effective, it's very, very important. One of the things I'm most happy about is that the turnout has been just massive for every week, whether it's South Carolina or any place. I mean, it started pretty much with New Hampshire, and it really, Iowa, no matter where you go, it's records. I think it's actually the single biggest story in politics today. It's what's happening at the booth, the tremendous number of people that are coming out to vote. Some of the states are getting, in fact, one has 102% increase over 4 years ago. It's amazing, 102%. On average, you're talking about probably more than 50. You're talking about millions and millions of people, whereas the Democrats are down 30-35%. They're down from what they were. We're up by 50% and even more than that. You're talking about millions of people. So I actually think it's the biggest story in politics today. And I hope that the Republicans will embrace it.
Okay. So here's a political quote, a summary from today. What less than a year ago looked to be the most talented Republican field in decades has been laid waste by a candidate whose stream of consciousness monologues, opaque policy positions, and racially charged populist nationalism have only made his reality show of a campaign, a hybrid of Seinfeld and All in the Family, impossible for rivals to compete and too compelling for the country to ignore. Kedren Bardwell, Trump attacked as never before by the Republican establishment, Mitt Romney and others this past week, yet he seems bulletproof. Why?
Well, I think some of those attacks are actually playing to his message and his angle. When someone like Mitt Romney comes up, it really begs for Trump to say, well, don't listen to Mitt Romney. He's a loser. He's the one that we went with last time, and that didn't work out. So, I think some of these things happen. For example, Carly Fiorina coming out this morning and speaking on behalf of Cruz. Maybe someone like that would actually have more resonance to be able to speak to the benefits of Cruz and the dangers of Trump than someone like Mitt Romney, who's affiliated with the establishment.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, Jim McCormick?
Well, I think Trump is very much of a Teflon candidate, and I'm not sure that any of these attacks are going to be very persuasive, because if you look after poll, his supporters are, you know, made up their mind early. They are unlikely to change. So I think, you know, his message of being anti, I guess, sort of all kinds of things here has attracted, a kind of a coalition of people. So I'm not sure that the establishment, the so-called establishment, no matter who the spokesperson might be, can be persuasive with these kind of Trump supporters here. So it really looks to either the Republicans getting some more independence to come their way, or to somehow get some of the hardcore party identifiers back to them. But I'm not sure that any of these messages are going to resonate very well.
Mm-hmm. Ted Cruz winning one state yesterday. He positioned himself as an alternative to Trump. He won in Idaho yesterday. Of course, as you mentioned, the big date next week, Tuesday, March 15th, contest in Ohio and Florida. These are two winner-take-all states, not divvied up according to how much support you have. John Kasich, Marco Rubio making their last stands. So tell us, Kedren Bardwell, do you see John Kasich taking Ohio, Marco Rubio taking Florida, and what if they can?
I think maybe Kasich has a better shot at Ohio than Rubio has at Florida. I think we've seen a bit of an implosion of Rubio over the last several days, and people have been trying to diagnose exactly what's happened there. But I think in actually going down in the gutter with Trump, he actually hurt himself. People already had some concerns about someone a little bit younger, his age, running for president, and the issues of maturity. And I think really when he got down in the gutter with Trump, I think that really hurt him in terms of the image of being presidential.
Mm-hmm. And talking about Donald Trump perhaps wetting his pants on stage at a debate, the size of Donald Trump's hands, that's what you're referring to. Jim McCormick, what do you see next Tuesday?
Well, I think Ketterin's right. Ohio looks, I think, a good opportunity for Kasich. I mean, he's run in the state, been elected and so on. He's a known quantity there. But by the public opinion polls, if we can weigh those in here, he's about 6 points behind Trump here. But I think he would have a really good shot. But, you know,
what difference would that make if he won Ohio?
Well, I think, you know, he came in third, of course, in Michigan, although very, very narrowly, but, you know, by a few thousand votes or whatever. But I think it really gives him a shot in the arm in terms of, other primaries that come up, and he becomes sort of the more establishment alternative, because I suspect that after next Tuesday, even though Rubio's going to stay in, you know, he's going to probably get beat in Florida. And so then in terms of the establishment, who would they turn to? And particularly if Kasich would have some success in Ohio, and if he could win it by, you know, a substantial margin, that is by 5 points or more, I think it even would give him a boost to his candidacy here. But it's also important to see what happens in these other states. I mean, Illinois, you know, these Midwest states, are sort of crucial because they're battleground states in the general election as they are in the primaries. So, you know, what these other candidates do, in terms of Missouri or Illinois here, which are also going to be held next Tuesday, mm-hmm. I think is consequential. But I think, but Kasich could come out a big winner if he can win Ohio by a good margin, and as sort of expected that Rubio or Cruz cannot really do very much with Trump in Florida.
Okay, we're going to break. I'll just mention a new NBC News Wall Street Journal poll before we go to break showing Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders handily defeating Donald Trump in a general election matchup, while a clash between Clinton and Cruz or Rubio would be a toss-up. Share your thoughts, your questions, your comments on this Politics Wednesday. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Ketterin Bardwell of Simpson College, as we pick apart where we are in this race. And when we come back, we'll talk about how candidates have courted certain groups, the evangelicals, the black vote, the Hispanic vote. And we'll talk about how that's played into this race. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Ketterin Bardwell of Simpson College, where he's chair of the Department of Political Science at Simpson College in Indianola. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University in Ames, chewing over the latest results of the four states that had primaries or caucuses yesterday. Bernie Sanders with a surprise narrow, but surprise victory in the Michigan primary. Hillary Clinton winning big in Mississippi. Donald Trump winning three out of the four states for the Republicans and increasing his delegate lead in his march toward the nomination. We're asking for you, your thoughts, your questions, or comments as we chew over this latest chapter of the 2016 race for the White House. In just a few minutes, we want to talk about how certain groups, evangelicals, also minorities, have fit into this particular election. Before we do that, let's go to a few callers. Kevin is with us, joining us from Nichols. Hi, Kevin. What question do you have on your mind?
Hey, Ben. Yeah, thanks for having me on. Appreciate your guest. I wanted to ask a question. Someone that I think it was Kevin brought up the proportional versus all-in-one winning. And my comment or question is, how does the superdelegates fit into that scenario? To me, that seems like the most corrupt part of the Democrats' primaries and caucuses is that these superdelegates aren't tied to any votes. And with the number of superdelegates, it seems like the voters are only getting the 67% portion of their vote to count towards their delegates being, you know, put on to either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders.
Gotcha, Kevin. Let's toss that to Kedron, who you mentioned.
Yeah, I think the caller is right, which is that the superdelegate process is one that is not very small-D democratic. It's one that tilts the playing field toward the party elites, toward these elected officials that make up those superdelegates. And so if they want to roll behind a candidate, either a candidate who's already ahead or an establishment candidate who's actually behind, they can do so, and those several hundred extra superdelegates do tilt the playing field. So it is a little bit interesting. I've mentioned this to my students a few times. Democrats talk a lot about, you know, one person, one vote, about democratic small-D processes. But if you look at the nomination process, they've still got this element that actually tilts the process away from the people and toward the party elite.
Mm-hmm. But Kedron, perhaps the GOP would wish it had that sort of tilt on the playing field for its playing field, don't you think?
I think at this point in the process, they absolutely would, but they didn't foresee this type of nomination moving forward. And I think that's probably been what people have generally missed about Trump in general, is that when we analyze races and when strategists strategize races, what they're looking at is, well, what has happened in the past and how's that worked? And I don't think we've seen anything quite like this, both in terms of the amount of media coverage that Trump's been able to gather and the fact that he's been able to increase turnout in a number of these primaries and caucuses in a way that actually didn't rely at all on the establishment or even the conservative Republican voters. He seems to be bringing some new, entirely new element into the process, first-time voters, et cetera.
Kevin and Nichols, thank you very much for that interesting question. Let's go to Richard in Cedar Rapids for another quick one before we move on. Richard, thank you for joining us.
Hello.
Hello.
Well, very, very briefly, it just seems quite puzzling that people are willing to entrust a candidate who has never served in political office, and presidency is indeed a political job, and there's a lot of nuances about how to do it well. And then there's somebody like Kasich in Ohio that's really done a great job there. He won in a landslide, so he must have attracted a number of Democrats. And so it's just very puzzling why people are willing to take the kind of risk they are when you've got a relatively straightforward choice. So I was just curious if they could comment on that.
Okay, Richard, let's toss that to Jim. Richard, speaking for the voice of what we would say reason is, I guess, here in the political establishment.
Well, I think part of the explanation is that, you know, there's a preponderance of people think the country's going in the wrong direction here. There is that this sort of anti-government sentiment. I wouldn't say all the way to throw out all the bums, but I mean there is that kind of sentiment, and that, of course, is what you know, Trump has tapped into, and to some extent, Bernie Sanders, because he talks about the system being rigged all the time against you know, people that are working you know, excess number of hours. So you know, maybe that sort of thinking leads, it seems to me, to the idea that we need candidates who have not been so tied to the system that will come in and presumably try to make these kind of changes. I think it's a little bit myopic to think that an outsider can come in and fully understand the machinery of government very quickly, because it really, really does take time with the complex system that we have. But nonetheless, there is this kind of frustration that that things have not gone well, that, you know, gridlock has been a reality for some time.
Okay, but let's pivot over to talk about race in this race, meaning the black vote on the Democratic side, especially ahead of the Michigan primary. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton squared off at that debate in Flint, Michigan, where water quality was a topic of debate. But both were also asked about their racial blind spots as two white candidates. Here's, first of all, what Hillary Clinton had to say.
I can't pretend to have the experience that you have had and others have had, but I will do everything that I possibly can to not only do the best to understand and to empathize, but to tear down the barriers of systemic racism that are in the criminal justice system, in the employment system, in the education and healthcare system.
Okay, and here's what Bernie Sanders had to say to that same question.
When you're white, you don't know what it's like to be living in a ghetto. You don't know what it's like to be poor. You don't know what it's like to be hassled when you walk down the street or you get dragged out of a car.
Bernie Sanders getting a bit of blowback after those comments about ghettos from various places on the internet. Kedren Bardwell, talk about race as you see it in the Michigan primary and larger. The larger question, I guess, is why Hillary Clinton has captured the majority of the black vote in these primary contests.
Well, you have to start with the fact that there's a huge reservoir of trust with the Clintons and the Clinton family from her husband's presidency. And she had been working on issues as well that are of concern to the black community, all the way going back to working with the Children's Defense Fund, and then when she was First Lady working on issues related to health care specifically. So I think there was a large reservoir of trust there. I think Sanders comes off a little bit uncomfortable, and I think that soundbite was a good representation of his inability sometimes to connect on issues with different types of voters. People really gave him a hard time. You know, what are you saying? Is it that all blacks live in ghettos? Is it that all blacks are poor? And I think he's just not as adept. Remember, he comes from a state that's pretty overwhelmingly white. And so I think Clinton's just got more experience on speaking to these issues, and I think that comfort level shows.
We'll look at the GOP side and the black vote in 2012. Looking this up this morning, Mitt Romney in 2012 winning just 6% of the African-American vote, down from 11% that George W. Bush won in 2004. President Obama carried 93% of the black vote in that 2012 autopsy after the 2012 elections. The Republican Party was called to build a lasting relationship with the African-American community. Given what we've seen this primary, Jim, is the GOP any better off than they were in 2012?
I'm not sure. You know, the last couple of weeks have been really disastrous in terms of talking about the African-American community by Trump and with the KKK issue and his at least apparent reluctance to really condemn the KKK, although he said that he didn't quite hear the question and so on and later came out. So I think that will be continuing to be a problem here. And so I'm not sure that there's been much advancement. Certainly the other Republican candidates, to be fair, came out and, you know, condemned Trump's hesitancy or whatever. But I'm not sure that is going to be sufficient to advance that 6% or whatever, you know, sort of single-digit number there.
Mm-hmm. And likewise, in that 2012 autopsy after the last election, the GOP wanted to hit the reset button or readjust to capture more Latino voters. Now they have two Cuban candidates in this race. One frontrunner, though, who has made his big, building a big, beautiful wall and his anti-immigration position one of his trademarks. I wonder, Kedren, let me ask you this. Could Trump's position on immigrants actually energize more of the Latino base to support his opponent?
I think it could. If Trump is the general election candidate, you could see some good boost in the Hispanic turnout. That's one group that's been growing in the last few years demographically is Hispanics, and yet their registration and turnout rates lag those of African Americans in terms of looking at ethnic vote. And so, yeah, I think this is kind of the worst case scenario for Republicans, because if you look at that Growth and Opportunity Project report, the postmortem that they wrote after 2012, it said very clearly that they were going to need not just to speak differently about their issues, but they may need to change the way that they think about some of these issues like immigration in order to avoid what Lindsey Graham has called the demographic death spiral for the Republican Party. And I think this nomination is actually going full barrel in the other direction and is going to hurt them.
Mm-hmm. Kedren Bardwell with us of Simpson College. Jim McCormick also with us on this Politics Wednesday of Iowa State University. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about another important group that has played a part in this latest round of politics, our election cycle, the evangelical Christians. Evangelical leaders have started to come out expressing some incredulity and some concern over the evangelical support for Donald Trump, including Pastor Max Lucado, Russell Moore from the Southern Baptist Convention, also Albert Mohler, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He told NPR this week that perhaps it's time to rethink the term evangelical, at least when it comes to politics.
We have taken comfort in the fact that there have been millions and millions of us in America, and a part of that evidence has been the last several election cycles with the evangelical vote being in the millions. And now we're having to face the fact that evidently, theologically defined by commitment to core evangelical values, there aren't so many millions of us as we thought.
Okay. What do you think about that, Kedron? Here we have a front runner in the GOP capturing a sizable part of the evangelical vote, a reality television star married three times, a Presbyterian who says he's proud to be a Christian. He has won the support of, a third of the self-identified born-again Christians across the states that have held primaries.
I think one thing that this primary is going to spark is some reconsideration of the way that pollsters even measure this concept. The typical way of measuring it is to ask whether you consider yourself an evangelical or, quote, born-again Christian. And I think there's many areas of the country that are culturally Christian or culturally evangelical where that idea of being born again has lost its specific theological meaning. Well, it's like asking, you know, do you have a pulse? Well, of course, you know, of course I'm alive, you know. Of course I'm a cultural Christian. I've been born again Christian. I live in the South, for example. So I think it's not a very precise measurement that we're using to even get at the issue of who the evangelicals are. The second question that comes up in this is that there's just different types of evangelicals, and that's one of the things that the quote was referring to that you just played. And one of the things we notice once we start parsing the data is that there's a pretty big difference between high church attending evangelicals and low church attending evangelicals in terms of their vote. The high attenders going for Trump, or sorry, for Cruz and for Rubio, and the low attending group going for Trump.
Your thoughts, Jim McCormick?
Yeah, I think Kedron is really right on mark here in terms of how you operationalize an evangelical. We do know that church attendance is really a good predictor of, in terms of, you know, that religiosity measure is really tapping into something. So I think there really has to be a rethinking of that. I also think though that and this goes to even if they're culturally evangelical, you know, for evangelicals that are culturally in that mode, it's God and country, that they have a commitment to, and so I'm not sure that that's so surprising that they would latch onto a candidate that talks very much about patriotism and redoing the country and so on. So even if it's not a precise measure, it these things really kind of go together, at least in my judgment.
Give us a view before we perhaps turn to a couple international items. Kedron Bardwell, what do you see in the path Tuesday and beyond for these candidates? Where do you see this ending?
Well, now you're asking me to predict, which is a dangerous thing to do in this election cycle.
Very dangerous. Let me ask you this way. Is Clinton still the presumed nominee for the Democrats?
Yeah, I think the superdelegates pretty much put Clinton over the top. If you look at the actual delegate count, it's something like 760 to around 570. And so it's relatively close between Sanders and Clinton. But I think on the Republican side, maybe stepping back a little bigger picture, you could have a real party split happening here, and something that's not just a temporary one-year thing, but that might approximate what we've called in the past a full party realignment, where the voting coalitions shift underneath the feet of the parties over a period of a few decades. A couple things precipitating this. First, that we could go to convention with over half of Republicans seeing a Donald Trump general election candidacy as unacceptable. And despite that fact, he may actually get the nomination. And so you have a candidate going into a general election, perhaps in Trump, that has positions that are antithetical to conservative and Republican historic positions on issues like trade, entitlements, and some other issues. And so I think that you're really looking at a fissure in the party that's going to grow deeper and deeper.
Jim, your view?
Yeah, I think if it goes to a contested convention or a brokered convention is the outcome, I'm not so sure how valuable that nomination is going to be for that candidate that comes out of that convention that way. I think that's why you saw, even this weekend, the head of the Republican National Committee on one of the interview programs thinking that they're going to have a candidate with sufficient numbers. I think a brokered convention, a contested convention, however you want to describe it, would be just really disastrous for any kind of Republican prospects in the fall. And as Kedron said, it also may bode very ill for the future of the party as presently constructed.
as we talk about various groups weighing in this election and sort of categorizing groups and capturing the evangelical vote or the black vote here, let's go back to the races yesterday. Michigan, the black vote there was something that Hillary Clinton obviously heavily counted on. She got it in Mississippi, getting a whopping victory there. What was, Jim, did you look into the difference there between the minority votes?
Yeah, she won the black vote. It was 65 to 57 for Sanders. So it was not
in Michigan.
So it was not a wide margin. So I mean, obviously she got more votes, but Sanders. 65 to 31. Excuse me, but he got 57% of the white vote. So he won the white vote, and she won the black vote in Michigan. But you know, in Mississippi, it was like 8-1 or something like that, or got 90% almost of the African American vote here. And so Michigan, clearly Sanders had some success in at least getting some support from the African American community. I'm just interested to see how that plays in Ohio and how that plays in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And the other one is North Carolina. All of those are going to be next week. Can he turn some of his support in the African American community into actual votes that will challenge the percentage that Secretary Clinton got in these other places?
And the Latino vote, perhaps you can comment on that, Kedron Bardwell. We have a Democratic debate tonight, hosted by or moderated by Jorge Ramos. Perhaps an opportunity to court the Latino vote by both candidates.
Well, I think so. And if you look at the demographic trends going back the last several election cycles, Democrats have taken a real advantage with the Hispanic vote. It was not that long ago that George Bush got about 40% of the Hispanic vote, and that's really just a long shot. That's something that Republicans would dream of today. I think, and there's issues that they've emphasized both at the state and national level, including things like hardline immigration policies and even something like voter ID that have really turned off that specific constituency. So we're beginning to see, and this actually is true for Asian Americans as well, but the Democratic coalition is becoming much more ethnically diverse even than it already was. And the Republicans, especially if they nominate Trump, are going to be relying on a coalition that is really whiter and older than the Republican coalition has ever been.
Yeah, the age differential, if we can just throw that in, I mean, was really quite stark in Michigan once again between Sanders and Clinton. I mean, Clinton got the older segment of the population, and Sanders did just very well, and that's been a constant kind of pattern. And the problem for Sanders on that, of course, is will the younger voters actually turn out and vote?
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, we often love to have you on here to talk about some international politics. I'm sorry, we only have a minute or two left here. Perhaps you can tick off the list of things or mention a couple of things that you see on the radar. We've had so much happening. Iran.
Well, I mean, the two nuclear sites are really the
Iran
hotspots.
Iran and North Korea.
That's right. Those are the real hotspots at the present time, with you know, ballistic missile tests in Iran, and you know, saying that they've miniaturized nuclear warheads in North Korea, you know, and are threatening to assault the South Koreans and the Americans in their joint exercises that frankly they just began a couple days ago. So those are two hot spots to look at. I mean, and we always have in the background what is happening with ISIS, and there's been at least you know, some activity there in terms of the Americans trying to take out one of the ISIS leaders.
Right. And then the repercussions there, the European Union really having a difficult time also working with Turkey this week to do something about that refugee crisis.
That's absolutely right. I mean, that's sort of the fourth item that we could put in. And how much the European Union and what exactly Turkey wants. I mean, one of the things they obviously want is not only additional assistance, but in terms of maybe a swap kind of, or cutting down on the number of refugees that they have to take. But the longer-term goal, of course, is Turkey has always longed to get into the European Union, and we'll see if that's part of the negotiating process mm-hmm. as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, so they may be leveraging this.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
To
very good.
Yeah. That goes back decades, and the Greece has always opposed that membership.
That's right, and plus some European countries too, because you know it became a religious component as well, sectarian, because you know Turkey is primarily Muslim country, 99% Muslim, and so on.
Okay, Jim McCormick, Kedron Bardwell, we've run out of time. I want to thank you both for giving us your astute analysis of politics at home and a little bit abroad there at the end. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Kedron Bardwell, chair in the Department of Political Science at Simpson College in Indianola. Kedron, Jim, always a delight to have you two on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll focus on advancements in research on cancer. You'll want to tune in for that. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.